You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people.
Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube and podcast land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that often lift and separate them from the average genre fare. Are you new to us? Well, if you are, David and I have been talking sci-fi and horror movies for quite some time. We go back a few years, and now we're just kind of reconnecting with these films and sharing our unscripted ramblings with you. Those of you that are new to us, that's what we do. Those of you that are returning, we are very grateful to have you here. You obviously have found something that you identify with, and we like finding people that are interested in the same things we are. So I am here with my good friend, David Horton. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. That was a good one. Look at you with your impromptu, just not rehearsed at all.
I was trying to do my PBS voice a little bit less bombastic.
Well, we're glad to be here, glad to be back, and all that fun stuff. We kind of like to start as a buffer or as just a kind of an icebreaker with what have we been doing in our genre week? What have we been doing since last we recorded, and genre specific for each of us? Mine actually was suggested by you. I think you... Months and months and months, maybe even a year.
There's a long list of things I've suggested to you that you have not watched.
I'm working on it. I got my list. Anyway, so I decided I need to start delving into this list and get some of this stuff done. So I went and watched a documentary I had never seen before called Memory, The Origins of Aliens.
Yes. And oh, my God. That's great.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
Mostly because... it's not a making of.
Mm-mm.
It's not a, behind the scenes, like some commentary track that you have on a Blu-ray. This is a cohesive, I think one reviewer I looked at, because after I watched it, I wanted to know what other people thought and went to look at some reviews. People call it a video essay. And I went, that's perfect. That's a great description for this. Because he collates all of this collective...
concepts
of all of these varied people and how they all come together. And it does show behind the scene clips. It does show interviews. It does show the making of sort of photography and clips and stuff like that and reference. But it's so well directed and well put together about these concepts of why Alien developed, why it had the resonance and impact as a film that it did, and kind of like what we do, what it's done since then, how it revolutionized science fiction, horror, different elements of each, all that kind of stuff. I mean, we both love that movie anyway. We've done it. It was like
first season. It's due for a redux for sure.
Yeah, but it's just such a great historical look at filmmaking in the late 70s and how it was done. And I really, really, it's good for cinephiles, it's good for horror enthusiasts, good for science fiction enthusiasts, and good for documentary makers.
Well, I was going to say documentaries in general, because this is clearly somebody that's really skilled at the task of making a documentary, because he creates a narrative out of pieces. And it's just beautiful the way he did it.
And
I don't know, I can't remember who the director is on that.
It is a he. I think he is... hold on to my notes. He is Swiss.
Oh,
he's
okay.
A Swiss director.
Like Geiger.
Yeah.
And he's Swiss.
Alexandra O. Felipe, or Philip. And he's done another one called The People versus George Lucas.
Interesting.
Which I thought might be interesting.
Yeah.
And he's got one that reminded me of you called Doc of the Dead.
Oh, wait, I've seen that. That's on George Romero, right?
Yes.
It's been a long time, but I have seen that. It's long, too. I think it's a couple of hours.
He premiered it at South by Southwest and in, I think, 14, it says in my notes, in 2014.
I need to revisit that. I didn't realize it was the same guy.
And it is all about entertainers that have had impact on and been affected by the zombie genre and culture.
Oh, so maybe I'm confusing it with a different documentary. I think the one I saw was on George specifically. Of course,
no,
he
this
would be
is
a large part of
all
that.
Of them aggregate. So it's got okay. like even Simon Pegg. It's got George Romero, Simon Pegg, Bruce Campbell, Tom Savini. Okay. Greg Nicotero.
I'm going to look that up. I may be confusing it with a different one then. I want to see that.
Yeah, and again, him able to tell this story from a very, and he's got another one where called 7852, which I haven't seen, but I'm going to watch it next. It came out in 2017, and it's just a deconstruction of the shower scene in Psycho.
That's the number of shots.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
78 shots in 52 seconds.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great name. I mean, it's just, well, for nerds like us, it is.
agreed. But he has quite a plethora of genre specific documentaries that I was totally unaware of. And before I get off of it, so Doc of the Dead was one I wanted to recommend to you. The 78 Leap of Faith, William Friedkin on directing The Exorcist.
These are all the same guy that did Memory.
Yeah.
He is making – that's wild. It's like he's a documentary guy that's doing what we do, but he's making – that's amazing. That's awesome.
And a new one that came out in 2022 that I'll hold off on watching, but I want to watch eventually, called Lynch/Oz. And it is the – it explores the influence – what it says here in the description. Explores the influence of the film The Wizard of Oz on American filmmaker David Lynch.
Wow, this guy has read a lot of bomb into Lynch films. That's funny.
Yeah, yeah. So, and again, if any of these are as good as Memory, they would well be worth it.
I would say it was excellent. I mean, obviously, people get better as they progress. So, I would try to look at like the order they're in because I have a feeling Memory's probably closer to more present. Because that's a fantastic documentary.
It is. Yeah. It is fantastic. But anyway, that's what I did in my genre week. I got to go back to one of our hybrid that we like, horror science fiction crossover, Alien by Ridley Scott.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's awesome. Well, I went back in my genre week to something too.
Yeah. Ooh, okay.
Something we have covered on the podcast and something that I mentioned in our 1950s top five. Mm. And it is a little ditty that you just love called Curse of the Demon. Night of the Demon is actually the British title, but over here we called it Curse of the Demon. It was directed by Jacques Tourneur, who, of course, did Cat People and I Walked with a Zombie. He met Val Lewton shortly before this, who was the new head of RKO at the time, and he asked Tourneur to be his first director that he hired for RKO. Excuse me. I know you're not crazy about this movie because of the monster that's in it, and we've spoke at length that the monster in it was added post by the studio. Jacques Tourneur was against it as well. Jacques is a very moody director, does a lot with shadow and light and just basically creates really dread-filled moods, I guess you would say.
Yes.
It was written by Charles Bennett, who was a frequent Hitchcock collaborator. But it's based on the M.R. James story, Casting the Runes. Stars Dana Andrews, Peggy Cummings, Niall McGuinness, who played the evil Dr. Carswell that was based on Aleister Crowley. I know that it's funny. You and maybe another person or two will say, "Ooh, that movie is terrible." But I have more people comment to me, "Oh, my God, I love that movie. That movie is so great." And I was trying to figure out why it is that you don't like it and that I do and that others do. And I made some notes that it's a landmark in the horror history for pedigree alone, obviously, all the people I just mentioned. But I think it's a bridge from Universal movies to Hammer movies.
I could see that.
It's noirish, like black and white noir stuff, like Universal.
Yeah.
Because Universal was predominantly black and white with the monsters and stuff. But it's dealing with a newer subject matter, which is satanic worship. I did watch an old Universal the other day that has Satanism in it that I did not know of. But this one, to me, was one of the first movies where it was the demons clunky, as I said, and he was against it. But it reminds me of a cross between like a gargoyle and Godzilla.
Yeah.
It's very stiff, like a gargoyle.
Stiff would be an understatement.
Like it's
for the
on
monster.
Wheels. And they're pushing it toward the camera.
Help me remember, is this the one that has like the car chase in part of it? In the rambling, the guy leaves the satanic ritual in his car and gets like attacked.
I think you're thinking of The Devil Rides Out. But there is a car wreck in this one where a guy slams into a telephone pole and gets like electrocuted or whatever. He gets killed.
Right. So, okay. And then there's the train.
There's the runes.
Where you're giving the runes to people and the runes.
He's trying to pass them and he's trying to pass them back to Carswell. Yes.
Because they're genuinely cursed.
Mm-hmm.
If you hold
that paper, you're going to die. But what I was going to say is, even though the monster's kind of clunky, I think it was probably pretty scary to people back in the day. I mean,
I would definitely think so.
Yeah, it's very memorable.
This was, I think we even mentioned it on the podcast, that this was the first time we could remember, you know, really satanic rituals being...
Right. Like I said, I have since seen another Universal movie where they have it, but I did not know of that Universal at the time. I can't remember what it's called. Oh, it's called The Black Cat. It's on our list. So, and I think somebody pointed that out to me in a comment back when we covered this. And it's on our list. We'll look at that because I liked it, actually. Mm-hmm. It had both Bela Lugosi and Karloff in it.
Right.
Anyway, I think it would be this movie was probably pretty scary to people, especially those unfamiliar with the occult and Satanism and it being their initiation. A synopsis is American professor John Holden arrives in London for a conference on parapsychology, only to discover that the colleague he was supposed to meet was killed in a freak accident. Mm-hmm. It turns out the deceased colleague had been investigating a cult led by Julian Carswell. Though a skeptic, Holden is suspicious of the devil worshiping Carswell. Following a trail of mysterious manuscripts, Holden enters a world that makes him question his faith in science.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie gets 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I didn't look to see how many reviews it has. I wouldn't give it 100, but I would give it a 90. I like it. I know that we disagree on that. But anyway, I just wanted to revisit it.
Well, that's awesome. And I think it was definitely a key or an influence on Roddenberry later on doing Spectre, the made-for-TV pilot that he wanted to do about a British parapsychologist, supernatural investigator who gets called to a Lord's manor home and all this stuff happens in Boston.
Oh, cool.
Very, very 70s television, but a fun ride.
So, nice.
Yeah, similar. There's no segue at all.
There is no segue. I was just thinking the exact same thing.
Where we are going today, other than there are some
monsters.
Tense sequences and monsters in this. We are jumping to 2005.
Yeah, modern day.
This is a modern retelling of the H.G. Wells classic novella, as well as the radio play by Orson Welles in the 30s. It's directed by Steven Spielberg. The writer is Josh Friedman and David Koepp. I found out that is the way to pronounce his name.
Koepp.
I, for most of my years, have said Cope. But it is kept, and I don't think we need to really go into a huge synopsis of this. If you have not read that novel or heard that radio play or seen the 50s version, go do all of that right now, please. I recommend
especially
all
the 50s version.
The 50s version. Well, and the Wells one, the radio play is really good.
Okay.
It's a great, it's dynamic, it's cool, it's neat. Look, do all that and then come back and we'll continue talking about this particular one. Had you seen this movie before?
I had not.
Ah, and
imagine that.
Stars one of your One of Tim's least favorite actors.
An actor that I had only seen one of his movies, which was Interview with a Vampire, until we started doing this podcast, and David keeps throwing him at me. But yeah, Tom Cruise is not my favorite actor.
But you did tolerate him in Minority Report, which was good.
I did, which was also Spielberg. And this is, of course, his second collaboration with Spielberg. And probably his last, because
definitely his last.
Yeah, he pissed Spielberg off.
Yeah. I did not see this movie when it came out, but I saw it when it came out on DVD and watched it then. And people who listen to the podcast, you guys know that I am an avid Steven Spielberg fan. He is my idol. He is someone I always wanted to emulate, even as a kid, someone I like a lot. He has had a few clunkers and a few problems with some films.
My biggest complaint with Spielberg usually involves children.
Well, he does have children a lot in his
but
films.
I do like the kid in this one. So,
well, it's Dakota, and she's so much better than Elle. Sorry, Elle, but it's true. Your sister's a better actress than you.
Poor little girl. What is she? But 20 I would say that
I would say this is one of Spielberg's missteps. This movie starts, I think, fairly well. It has a really good kind of first act, but then it is just a collection of action pieces that really make no freaking sense and don't work, in my opinion. Did you like it? What did you think?
Well, I want to say I liked it because we were discussing tropes earlier, and it is one of my favorite tropes as far as like apocalypse and no hope and just a fight the entire way. That's how the first movie is. However, this movie has some major problems. And to me, the main major problem is Tom Cruise. He is Joe Action Hero. And this movie did not need Joe Action Hero in the lead. It needed somebody like John Hamm or somebody that you don't expect that gets thrust into this. When I see him walking down the street when they're first seeing the attacks, and he's like talking to his homeboys on the block, he looks so out of place. I'm like, you don't look like you would be friends with them at all. Does that make sense?
Yes.
I think he was totally miscast.
Totally. I completely agree with you.
Good.
I think he is the major issue in this movie, is the fact that the character as written should be he's a longshoreman, literally. Hmm. He stacks containers as a union worker, mentions union in like his third line in the movie. Mm-hmm. And Tom Cruise is not that guy.
No.
And never is able to play that guy. Mm-hmm. Tom Cruise, if he is also the core spine of this character, is he is a terrible dad. He is a bad dad. He wants to be a good dad, but no, he'd really just rather the kids stay with
mom. I didn't
have
a problem with that, though, because that to me at least was kind of realistic. Just but not him as the part.
That's what I'm saying. I don't mind the character. That's a great idea for this lead in the movie. However, that is not Tom Cruise. Mm. Tom Cruise always has that cocky edge. That's what makes him a movie star.
Well, and he's like Rob Lowe. He's too perfect. Yep. Yeah.
So he is a big problem with this. Another big problem is this movie doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't make logical sense for an invasion force. It doesn't make sense for what is happening. It leaves so much to what really is happening, and I can't tell, and I don't understand. I mean, are they spraying blood everywhere? No, it's some kind of mist, but is it mist made out of blood? If it is, why are they capturing
humans? Are they using humans as fuel? Yeah. I was like, what?
And if they are using him as fuel, kind of terraform, because in the novel, the whole purpose, when he's stuck in that cabin for like 2 weeks in the novel, it's because they're terraforming. They're trying to change the atmosphere of Earth to be more like Mars. That's kind of the way Mars was. That's what they're doing. So that element is kind of stolen by Kep and put in the screenplay, but not explained at all and not told and doesn't make any sense. If that's what you were going to do and you need humans to do that, then why are you shooting the shit out of them from the very beginning? Why aren't you just capturing them to begin with?
Right.
Instead of just decimating and vaporizing everybody. Although that sequence, probably one of my favorite scenes.
It's awesome. I mean, it's clearly a key to 9/11 because, you know, she's constantly screaming, is it terrorist? Is it terrorist? And I was like, well, it does seem like it would be.
Yeah. Well, but he's covered in human ash.
I agree with you. And that's why I want to like this movie is because, God, the relentlessness of the first attack is just sublime. And it is, I was kind of blown away by it.
And his pacing, you know, heavily, again, we're keying already, but a huge key is Independence Day. But that whole storm approaching and, oh, it's kind of cool and we all want to stare up and watch it and then suddenly it gets scary. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. That was a good sequence.
Yeah. Too. I like bad weather. I love watching stuff like that.
The ferry boat sequence is a good sequence and has some really memorable. There's a lot of memorable shots in this. This is a very Spielberg movie.
Yeah.
So it has a lot of great cinematography and it's filmed well. The screenplay, though, is not good and does not work. The alien probe scene, cool scene. Doesn't make a lot of sense. They're wasting their time on every freaking house in the country, looking around the basements.
No.
And,
yeah.
You know, like, what the hell is that?
I mean, that was his homage to the original movie, obviously, but it went on too long.
And that scene is in the novel just because one of the crafts crashes near that house, one of the meteorites, and in the novel, they have to build their ships once they crash. They don't just come floating out of them, even like the movie. They have to build, the aliens have to get out and build the tripods to attack, almost like, you know, an infantry unit trying to build the tanks and all that. So it takes time to do that. And while they're doing that, they just happen to search the nearby farmhouse to see what's happening. So it made sense in the novel. Makes no sense here because they are decimating the world.
I've never read this novel, so I didn't know that.
Ooh, you should. I think you would like it. Yeah. It's really, H.G. Wells' novel is really good. But David Koepp is also the guy who wrote Jurassic Park.
I was going to say, how many he done for Spielberg since Jurassic Park?
Well, he is his script doctor in general. So Josh Friedman, or Friedman, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but Josh Friedman actually wrote the screenplay, and Koepp was brought on as a fixer. As a doctor of it, change some sequences around, move some stuff, all of that. But yeah, he's done a lot with Spielberg and
I figured.
But he's got in my opinion, a 20% success rate.
I was going to say, because I mean, I love Jurassic Park, but I don't love this if he's anything to do with it.
Plus the fact that he did the Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull.
That's not a good one, though, is it?
No,
I didn't think
good.
So. Yeah, I liked the first three. I don't like the others really that much.
Four and five are not good. Well, I haven't seen five.
But, five is okay. I mean, it's interesting. But I remember not liking four. That's why I don't remember it.
Yeah, Crystal Skulls is not good. But, again, another thing might be, just saying this, but looking at researching this movie, this movie was done from start to finish in 10 months. It had over 500 special effect shots, and it was done in 10 months. So it was heavily rushed into production and into release. So much so that Spielberg filmed principally all of the action sequences first so that he could just concentrate on the stuff in the basement and the special effect shots for the rest of it. So all the action sequences were filmed up front. And maybe that's why he doesn't have any connective tissue to them or any time for us to really care about anybody in this movie, because other than maybe the Dakota Fanning character.
I was going to say, it's only the little girl I care about. I hate her brother. He's an asshole. Yeah.
And he makes no sense. I get in the fairy sequence, he's kind of, oh, I want to help people. Great.
Oh, I'm going to make Dad proud. Or at least that's the shot from Cruise is, oh, my son is a good guy.
Right. Then I have to go over this hill to see the army do this. Okay.
And then get annihilated only to turn up in the final scene. I'm like, kidding? Are you fucking kidding me?
To me, it would have made much more emotional impact to me if she's hugging her daughter with the grandparents and she looks down at him he asks about, and she goes, no, or he goes, no, you know, so they don't, you know, shakes his head.
That would have been great. They totally fucked that moment up. And that's Spielberg. That's his fault.
Oh, well, probably.
Yeah. I mean, he made that decision. He could have changed that.
Let's add Robbie at the end.
And why let me tell you, here's another very good example of the exact same thing, is the Tim Robbins character. It's like, if you're going to make him basically what they're trying to do is what Walking Dead did 6 years later. You're in a world now where you may have to kill people. And it just, you know, it goes on too long. And I'm like, you know, you should leave, whatever. Just get away from this asshole.
Yeah, and it makes no sense. From his very opening shot of him holding up the shotgun saying, here, here, here. And they both go running down.
And they're the only ones out of all those people.
They're the only ones out of all those people running that go down here. And then later on, Cruz is all pissed off at him saying, why did you invite us in here? Why did you bring us down here? Oh, he didn't bring you down there. You went running down the freaking steps.
Yeah.
So he didn't bring you anywhere. Plus, again, it's one of those where if you know the backstory, it might help. There's a great scene in Orson Welles' radio broadcast where the lead character finds an artilleryman and he seems to know a little bit about what's happening, because the lead character is like kind of like the Cruz character or like the character in the movie where he doesn't really know what's going on until the one in the George Powell movie knows a lot more because he's a scientist.
Gene Barry.
Yeah. But in this, in the original novel and in this, he's not. So he is a scientist, but he's in the dark.
He's a teacher at some university.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the Orson Welles version, he is too, but he doesn't know what's going on. He meets this artilleryman. The artilleryman at first seems really knowledgeable. This is how we fought them. This is what we think, blah, blah, blah. What I think we need to do is get to the subways, because then we can exist. We can at least hold out and mount a defense, yada, yada, yada. But then he starts saying weird stuff and being really crazy and being really strange, so much so that the character has to run away from him because he's...
So Kep or whoever, Friedman, lifted that from the radio play.
Correct.
Okay.
And
so there's little bits of everything in this.
Yeah. So it, like I said, it is, if you haven't read the novel, seen the George Powell or heard the radio drama, go do all those first and then appreciate this, because there's elements of all three. And even then you might still not like it. Yeah.
Well, okay, I could watch the action sequences over and over. I just hate Tom Cruise. The action sequences, especially in the beginning, the initial attack, is amazing. It just kind of blew me away. But I also love those kind of apocalyptic scenarios, whether it be zombies or what have you.
Oh, yeah. And this one's done really well. You know,
other things. We didn't mention scenes. We kind of just rambled into this, really. The Venom immediately. But, I mean, I think we've already discussed the main scenes. And they are the opening attack, the scene in the basement with the probe, and the ferry boat scene are really the three main scenes that stick out to me.
Yes.
Okay. The same. And the ending, maybe. I don't know.
I'm the same. We overlook scenes that, although filmed well and look really good, don't work for me. Like the whole, when they're in the car and rushing, on the interstate, it's one shot. And the camera's going around and around the car.
Oh, wow.
Pausing for different. But if you look back at it, all of that is one shot. Even the camera pulling back and cars coming in between them as they're racing, all of that is still one shot. So it's a very technically well done scene. It just makes no sense that he's able to go 70 miles an hour through all those cars, and there's always an opening with no people, no cars, no nothing.
Right.
Same thing with the scene in your picture right there. The same thing with the scene with where the car is carjacked, essentially. Nice mood there. Nice photography. The way it's shot makes no logical sense. One gun against that whole crowd wouldn't make a freaking difference. They would beat you to death.
Right. Well, we know that from some of them were not. Some of them were not actually attacking him. There just weren't enough of the good guys. Then good guy, bad guy ratio. I did like that scene though, because I do think that is exactly what would happen. You know, and he knew it would happen. That's why he said, "Don't quit driving." But then they got into traffic, and they should have just abandoned the fucking car.
Well, and what I do like about that sequence is the way it ends. So I do like the fact that I didn't like the fact that everybody wouldn't just beat him to death and take him and the kids or whatever. It didn't matter. But the one guy saying, I'm taking the car. Here, get your little girl. I'm taking the car. He gets in.
And they just do the same thing.
Another guy picks up a gun. They go into the diner, and you see through the windows of the diner,
yeah,
the car, the guy come up beside the car and just shoot the guy in right. the car. Mm-hmm. I was going, that's humans.
Yeah. I was like, why would you take the car? You know they're just going to do it to you, too.
Yeah. And again, a totally, you know, key or homage scene, because that's the scene in the, remember, in the George Powell movie where they turn the truck over. He has the antidote. And has the gear that they need in the truck. And he runs into the mob and they mm-hmm. end up turning the whole truck over and beating him. That's why he has to go to the church at the
yeah.
end.
Yeah. Yeah. He's looking for Ann Robinson's character. I can't think yeah. of her name.
And the other scene is we suddenly get into this weird, again, Shotwell makes no sense. This whole thing after the basement when the red vines are everywhere, but it almost looks like blood pools and blood sprayed everywhere. And they're picked up and put in the cages on the tripods, but he can blow one up and then they all still survive. And why just...
Well, when that cage fell into that tree and got caught, I was yeah. like, they would all be impaled, man.
Every one of them would have been impaled, or most of them would be. Yeah,
yeah, they would have sticks in their bodies. Yeah. I wanted to go back to the car thing, because this is another thing that did not make sense to me, mm-hmm. is getting the car initially, or it's a van, isn't it? I think it's a van.
No, it's SUV, maybe. SUV, yeah, with a sliding.
Anyway, yeah. When they get who is the guy they get it from? Because obviously Tom Cruise knows the guy. Why does the car work when no other cars work? I mean, I don't understand any of that.
It is, okay. Well, again, convenience, plot armor kind of thing. The guy is the local mechanic who's just right on the corner because he sees him earlier on
okay.
when he's going to investigate. The guy is trying to fix it, and he goes, have you replaced the solenoid? And he goes, solenoid, see, I told you I should have tried to replace the solenoid. Let's do that, blah, blah, blah. So the car that just happens to miraculously that be there with the keys in it and unlocked, he replaced a solenoid in.
That is way too contrived. I can't.
On top of the fact that they have mentioned for a good 5 minutes of this pre-movie here that the EMP pulse is what knocked out Paris and or Ukraine. I thought that was ironic. It was Ukraine that was uh-huh. is where the first missile, or the first lightning struck. But an EMP would also fry every solenoid. Same way it stops your watch. Stops all anything that with a battery or with a charge would be stopped. So that's what it would. So a solenoid wouldn't work anyway to replace it. And yet it does. And it's the only working car on this side of the coast or whatever. I don't know. It just.
You just reminded me of something else and I can't remember what it is. But there was something else that was bothering me about this as well. Besides the fact that none of the
a plane crashes right beside your house.
Oh yeah,
and doesn't hurt your house except for the whole front wall. But you know, literally a jet engine right beside a desk and a chair that are just sitting there, so nice and sweet.
Well, it's kind of just like a gigantic boat propeller just being right next to you, and you're yeah. gonna swim away.
You're gonna swim away.
A ferry boat propeller that's like huge. Anyway, yeah. No, what I'm getting at is I understand that modern science tells us that there, you know, these Martians or these aliens would not be from Mars. So I get Spielberg changing it to just another planet and having, of course, I get having Morgan Freeman narrate it because that's gold. But
yeah, always.
Why, if they look at it, if they use that opening paragraph from the Wells book, which they do in the other movie as well.
Yep.
If they're eyeing Earth with envy mm-hmm. to invade it, then why would they have planted ships in the Earth's surface billions of years ago? It makes absolutely no sense at all.
Nope. And there are other shots where they're showing, you know, when he's with the TV lady, she's showing him somewhere. I can't remember where she said, but you see like 8 tripods all firing and moving and walking and everything else. And I'm going, Okay, and nobody ever hit those with a mine or a well or a subway tunnel or anything? Oh, maybe they're buried really deep. Yeah, no, they're not. That you don't eye with envy if you already know you're going to invade them
exactly.
Because you planted your ships there. Secondarily, what a stupid freaking plan. I mean, it's just, what? And you ride the lightning into the ship somehow? If you can, what?
It's just, it's like a special effects for special effects sake, maybe. Like they just thought this would look cool. Let's do this.
A lot of the decisions I could understand. Like I like the design of the tripods.
Oh, they look really great. Cool. Yeah,
I like the design of the aliens. Although they're very similar to Independence Day, but right. I like the design of them. But
I have those somewhere.
I don't right understand there. the logic of the attack or what they want or why they're doing it. Or what the purpose is. The whole ending is so, again, it's like if you had seen the original, then you get it. As soon as Tom Cruise looks at that and it's all dried and crusty and he squeezes it and it turns into ash, you go, oh, they're dying. Okay, that makes sense. And then they show the big one dying and he has to tell the military who have been fighting these things for however long, at least a few days, that look at the birds and they don't have shields and you can shoot it now and all of that. And then they slowly die and the hand comes out, which is directly from the 50s movie.
The original movie. Yeah, the 50s movie.
Yeah.
And something, the 50s movie is a lot of destruction too. And then all of a sudden they start dying. So it is kind of abrupt. I've always thought that. But it seems more abrupt in this. It seems
very.
It doesn't work. I mean, it almost doesn't work in the 50s version, but I can give them that. In this one, it doesn't work at all.
Well, and there's an explanation, that whole epilogue, again, Morgan Freeman's voice, you know, talking about brought down by the smallest things in God's creation. That's also from the Wells teleplay. As well, a radio play, okay. As well. That whole kind of epilogue kind of explains it. And it did in the 50s film, too. It just felt more natural in the 50s film.
I think. In the 50s, they added a little more religion to it, too.
Well, they really emphasized that God in his infinite wisdom.
Right. They didn't do that as bad in this, but they did.
Well, they had to make up for the fact that one of my favorite shots in the 50s is that the
priest
going
annihilated. Yes.
No.
He's like, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And then you just see Ann Robinson scream. I watched it last night.
I love it.
I rewatched it because I was like, I need to see this again before we do this podcast because I really like that 50s movie a lot.
I've always loved the design. I've always loved the color in that, the way they do the neutral colors.
The flying things that
have the machines are awesome.
Yeah. And another reason why I think the end transpires more subtly in that is because you see one crash before you know anything. So you're like, why did that thing just crash? And it's because they're dying.
Yeah.
That's like the introduction to it.
See, it would have been better, in my opinion, had he said, the birds, look at the birds, no shields, man, no shields. And they all go, oh, okay, blah, blah, blah. Let's get ready to shoot it. And before they even can, it suddenly falls.
Yeah, that would have been much better.
Because we would have said, okay, something's
wrong. Yeah.
You know, but no, we don't get that because we have to go for the explosions. It's like Michael Bay took over Spielberg's body or something.
Yeah, the big thing was, oh, let's have it crash through this old factory or whatever. Yeah, stupid. Yeah.
And that's another thing that kind of doesn't work in this movie, even in the action sequences, is there's a lot of freaking narrow escapes in this movie, especially by the Tom Cruise character. I mean, by like, especially in that opening section. I mean, he runs into a store and a person right beside him is vaporized, but he's not. And then the guy in front of the camera is vaporized, but he's not. He keeps running towards us.
And cars are being hurled at him.
Yeah.
And he's like, doing this because glass is just breaking everywhere. And I'm like, yeah, you – first of all, I thought was – I kept screaming at the television, run behind a building. If you run behind a building, they can't see you. You're on a city block. There's a building next to a building next to a building. You can easily run down an alley to at least not be in their line of sight.
Go sideways.
And no, I'm going to run out in the street where everyone else is.
Yep.
No.
I agree. And like, you know, we get to my ex-wife's house and the whole basement catches on fire, but we can close the door and keep us safe in this little pump room. But, oh, no, a jet hit the entire neighborhood except for our house, and we're still safe down here, and there's no bodies anywhere.
Oh, yeah, no bodies on that plane. They all just flew out, I guess.
Right. Later on in that other sequence, we're smart enough to know Rachel made a noise with her foot, so let's take her shoe off and leave the shoe there for the stupid alien to see. These guys traveled millions of miles in all of, you know, billions of miles in these incredible ships and or lightning or whatever. They're an advanced alien race, but they get confused by a mirror? Really? The whole front of this thing is a mirror.
Yeah, you know, if they are coming down in the lightning, does that mean they're orbiting the planet and just sending little ships in through the clouds?
Who knows?
They're seeding the clouds.
They're seeding the clouds. He gets in a car and the tentacle comes down and goes, almost gets him. He climbs into a car. It goes through the car,
right.
Picks it up, slams him down, and he can still crawl out and see Rachel through the glass and go to her. I mean, just there's so many narrow escapes that are just unbelievable. They just
well, and the don't one work. Where they're in the cage and it sucks him up through the giant anus.
Yeah, yeah, but he happens to have the two grenades.
That right, that's a very narrow escape too. And like I said, if that cage had fallen, they would have all died anyway.
Yeah, yeah, easily, and just so many in it. The fair, like you said, whole ferry boat with the propeller, everything.
And were you not screaming? And this is the first time I've seen it, of course, but I was screaming the whole time. You don't want to be on that boat.
Nope.
You don't want to be on that boat. They're going to shoot that boat.
This is not a zombie invasion.
I didn't think about there being one underwater, which to me was just totally irrelevant because they could have just blasted it from the land because they were coming towards it anyway. But all of a sudden, they wanted to upturn the boat, I guess, for the special
effects.
One of
my favorite shots from this is that when you're essentially from the boat's point of view and you're seeing the whole hill and all these hundreds of people flooding in, and in the background are the three machines.
Yeah.
Slowly walking towards you. And I was going, yeah, that's War of the Worlds, man. Would have been so much better. I don't know. I think the extremely rushed production schedule really affected Spielberg and his decision-making and the scripting and everything.
Well, do you think it was rushed because of Tom Cruise? Because it seemed to me like Tom Cruise kind of told Spielberg, we need to do this now. I read that somewhere, maybe in my notes, and I'm like, is this his fault? Because it probably is. I like to blame everything on him.
I know you do. That's okay. I mean, I don't know. Possibly. In my research, the big thing was just literally from green light to release was 10 months on a movie this huge and this epic and this much detail. That's fast.
I love how we just jumped in and just started eviscerating it immediately. We were like on a tear there. We weren't even sticking to our format.
No.
Do you want me to go on into casting now?
Please do.
Okay.
Let's spend a lot of time on Ray Ferrier, the lead.
Oh, my God. A couple of things before the cast, as far as production. Do you know who Spielberg and Tom Cruise wanted to write this but couldn't?
I read that, and
they wanted
Abrams.
Yeah, they wanted JJ, and he was developing Lost at the time, and he couldn't do it. He didn't have the time for it.
Well, it would have been a bunch of mysteries that never got explained anyway.
That's true. It probably wouldn't have been that great either.
Yeah.
And then did you know that there was another attempt at a remake of this film before this one?
I had read that, yes. But I didn't read details about it.
Well, guess who was slated to direct it?
David Lynch.
George Romero.
Oh!
I don't know how good he would have been because he's never really done big action sequences before.
Yeah. That's the thing that bothers me about it. I don't know how he would have done
that. But, I mean, when he had money, I mean, I wasn't crazy with Land of the Dead, but I loved Creepshow, and that was a pretty big budget, I would think.
Yeah.
So, anyway, it was quickly redeveloped into a series called War of the Worlds from 1988 instead. So that's why Romero's film didn't come about. Or that's what happened to it. I'm not sure if that's the reason. Tom Cruise plays Ray Ferrier. I mentioned, well, all right, let me just read this. Spielberg said after reshooting that he would never make a film with Tom Cruise again. Blunt statement.
Yes.
The reasons given were for Cruise's behavior on the set related to involvement with the controversial Church of Scientology. Yep. Cruise was rumored to have tried to convert Spielberg, and especially his erratic performance on Oprah Winfrey's episode dated May 23rd, 2005. I think you may remember this, mm-hmm. when he started jumping up and down on her couch and acting like a crazy person.
Yep.
Spielberg felt that hurt the movie. The riff was, you know, as far as they were in the midst of publicizing that, he was there to publicize that movie, and that and he was acting like an idiot. The riff was further said to be caused by Scientology's well-known opposition to psychiatry, which reportedly comes from its founder, L. Ron Hubbard. After several psychiatrists had rejected his spiritual healing theories and suggested that he suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. Spielberg was unhappy with Cruise, repeated rants against the use of Ritalin in children with ADD, and was especially angered when a psychiatrist friend of his was harassed by Scientologists after he had mentioned the doctor's name in Cruise's presence. However, they seem to have made amends in 2023 when a clip was released of them hugging and Spielberg praising Cruise for saving the movie industry with Top Gun Maverick. Whatever. Anyway, I had to get that history out there, folks. It's not just me that doesn't like Tom Cruise. So that's all I'm going to say about him.
I liked Minority Report. I thought he was good in Minority Report. Again, because what was his character like at the very beginning? A really cocky ass. Mm-hmm. And Cruise is really good at that.
Yeah.
Another reason why I think A Few Good Men is probably his best movie ever.
Well, it helps that Jack Nicholson and Demi Moore are in it, but yeah.
Oh, yeah. And everybody else in that. I mean, Kiefer Sutherland's in that.
I was thinking of Vigo, but that's G.I. Jane. Never mind. Demi Moore movie.
Wrong Demi Moore movie. But you know, and I don't mind him in the Mission Impossibles for what they are.
I think they saw the first one. I don't remember.
You know, and much better in the latter ones, because in the first one, he is double-crossed. And it's a typical, you know, bad James Bond kind of mystery story. But the rest of them, he's more of the, this is my team. I'm the one in charge. I can get everything done. I'm the superhero kind of thing, which works for Cruise. Mm-hmm. There's another movie that hopefully we're going to have on our list pretty soon, which is another science fiction one where he's pretty good as well.
Okay.
But we'll see. I think he's horribly miscast.
You're talking about Oblivion. I think you mentioned that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, I sometimes describe this. I listen to a podcast where the podcaster has an irrational hatred for Tia Leone. He can't explain it, but he has an irrational. And I want to say my hatred for Tom Cruise is irrational, but I don't think it's irrational at all. I think there's plenty of examples why I don't like him. And you want to know something else? I've always had the exact same irrational hatred for Will Smith, and look at him. Same kind of, just don't even go there. So if you ever pick a Will Smith or a Tom Cruise movie, you're likely to see me go off. So anyway.
Well, Men in Black works for Will. That's a good one.
They all have a movie, but also the movie that they have has other people in it. Will in Black has Tommy Lee Jones in it. I mean, you can't get a better actor than Tommy Lee Jones.
Yep.
True. So, well, anyway.
But yes, I agree. I just think he is just horribly miscast in this. Mm-hmm. Was anybody else considered?
I don't have anybody. No, this was a thing that Spielberg and Cruise cooked up together. But both of them had very demanding schedules. Spielberg was wanting to shoot Munich, and Tom Cruise persuaded him to put Munich on the back burner and do this. So
I'm sure Munich probably had a deadline. You know, we have to start in 10 months shooting Munich.
Something like that. Yeah. And I just feel like Tom Cruise is the reason why this movie had to happen real fast. I think Spielberg was just being a nice guy and said, okay, yeah, let's go ahead and do it. And he bit off, you know, a big hunk that was hard to chew. So anyway.
Well, and also couldn't do any of the things that he does well. I mean, there's no nuance. Redemption. There's no redemption for Ray in this. Like what happens. Close Encounters is a good key for this. And, you know, there's no redemption for Ray. He's a bad dad and he stays a bad dad. He wants to do good, but he can't and doesn't. So anyway.
Dakota Fanning, who is the light in this dark movie, is Rachel Ferrier. Love her. She first came on the scene, I think, in I Am Sam, that movie with Sean Penn. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then she is an adult actress now. But the only complaint I have on her is in the beginning when she is screaming constantly. I can't stand hearing little girls scream. It drives me crazy.
Well, nobody can. I think that's kind of the point.
Right. Yeah. But other than that, I think she's fantastic in it.
I highly recommend a few things by Dakota. And like I said, that's why I think Dakota's much better than Elle. Mm-hmm. Elle is in a movie called Super 8, which is also on our list.
It is on our list. And everything else. Yeah.
But there's a movie that she did, an independent movie called Please Stand By. And it's Dakota Fanning as a, what do they call it? Neurodivergent person who is obsessed with Star Trek. She loves Star Trek and she has written her own screenplay for Star Trek or an episode. And she hears, this is during Next Generation's time in the 90s.
Okay.
And she hears that they are taking unsolicited scripts. So she decides to run away from her home where they take care of her to give her script to the people that run Star Trek. And it's all about her cross-country journey. And she is brilliant. It's almost exclusively a one-hander almost all the way through. She is just wonderful in it. Please Stand By is the name of it. Another one, she's in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tarantino one. She plays Squeaky Fromm.
I haven't seen that yet.
She plays Squeaky Fromm, and she's really good
in it. From the Manson family? Wow.
Yes. Yeah. And she is in The Alienist, which is a series based on Caleb Carr's book, and it's really good. Think of the birth of forensic science in the late 1800s. And she is an alienist. She's a scientist who studies bodies and tries to find killers. And it's really good.
It's interesting that you mentioned that movie about her wanting to send in an unsolicited script to Star Trek, because I always wanted to do that for the X-Files.
Of course.
Mine was the X-Files. Yes. I wanted to do it really badly. But then I think about us on Patreon. Sorry for this little segue, folks. But on Patreon, we always talk about how Roddenberry would fuck up other people's scripts by rewriting them.
Yep.
Well, Chris Carter did the same fucking thing. He rewrote the Stephen King episode and turned it into a piece of shit. So Chris Carter was like the modern or the
Gene
next.
Roddenberry.
Yeah, he was like the Roddenberry of the 90s, basically.
Makes sense.
Didn't mean to go off. If you want to hear more of our rants on any kind of Star Trek or X-Files, you need to go over to Patreon.
That's right. And watch Please Stand By, because Dakota's great. She's good.
Miranda Otto played Mary Ann. I'm assuming that's the mother, because there were no other females except for the woman that got lost on the ferry.
I have that
she played Eowyn in Lord of the Rings in a couple of the movies. It's been a while since I've seen them, so I'm not really familiar. She was in the latter two movies, right?
No, she's in Hobbit. She's Eowyn. She fights the.
She's in the Two Towers and Return of the King, but yeah, not she in the Hobbit. I mean, not in the first one that we covered earlier.
She fights the Nazgul. She's from Gondor.
Okay.
She's a warrior.
Because I was going to say, I don't remember her from the one we covered in January, so it must be the latter two.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
The part was offered by Spielberg as she turned it down because she was pregnant.
Yep.
And Spielberg wanted her to play the part, so he changed the script to incorporate the pregnancy into the role. And I thought that was nicely done. I didn't mind that at all. See, Spielberg did that. He could have changed the ending.
Yes, he could have changed a lot.
Justin Chatwin played Robbie. I have nothing else on him and don't really care because I hate him.
He went on to do something big. I can't remember what it was.
He looked like familiar to me, but I don't know.
He's like a voice actor who's done something really big. I cannot remember what it was, but yeah. He was so, I so did not like his character from the very beginning. You know, we talked about, you know, when you're writing a screenplay or a novel or whatever, that character entrance is so important.
It is.
How your character is first seen. And he's seen as ignoring his entire family and just being a sullen teenager. And
well, I know. I mean, and even if he has that resentment toward his father, all they had to do was give you a little nugget to have some sympathy for him. And they don't.
Something.
That's what I love about Dakota Fanning in the very beginning when she looks at Tom Cruise and says, you're not going to get through to him that way or right. whatever. And I was like, oh, wow, that's an adult observation from a kid who's younger
yeah.
than everyone else in this movie. So that made me love her immediately when she said that.
And I think they wanted it to be that scene when the convoy is coming by and he has the big screaming match with Ray. Mm-hmm. About, I want to go do something with my life. You never do anything, that kind of stuff. I think they wanted that to be his rationale. And finally, them having a huge come to Jesus moment, so to speak, whatever. But that didn't work.
It's played out in the wrong part of the movie. It's not sympathy at all. I don't feel sympathetic for him at all because it's like, dude, you are in a life and death situation and you've got, you know, your little sister here. What the fuck? You know, yeah. Stop it.
Doesn't work at all.
No.
Yep.
Tim Robbins played Harlan Ogilvy. We know him, of course, from Shawshank Redemption. Ironic, considering that Morgan Freeman is a narrator of this movie.
I doubt they met, though, on this movie.
Probably not. I would say Morgan Freeman did that from home. Do you know who his original choice was?
Oh, no. For the Harlan character? No.
For the Harlan character? Bill Murray.
Oh, God.
Geez, I know. Really I would have sucked. Not been able to take him seriously, I don't think.
No. Not for this. I mean, Robbins does well in this part. It's just that this part feels like it's from a different freaking movie compared to everything else in the movie. It just doesn't fit and work, but he's really good at it. You know,
he's going to be good. Right.
The creepiness of that scene where Ray is asleep, finally dozing. He wakes up and he goes around the corner and the guy is sitting with his daughter, and the first thing he hears is, you know, if anything ever happens to your dad, I'll take care of you. You go, oh, fuck no. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's borderline creepy, but not. But then his ideas are all there about, what are you going to do, Ray? We've got to fight. We've got to do something. What's your plan? What's your plan? You know, and it's like, yeah, you don't have one.
I just have a few spatterings left with cast. Yul Vasquez, who played Julio, was in The Outsider. I don't remember him, but we watched The Outsider for a bonus episode.
He's in Severance, too. He's in Severance, okay. the Apple series.
And then these other people that are in it that I recognize, I don't remember seeing. Lisa Ann Walker played the bartender. Do you remember that?
Well, since we never went in a bar, no.
Well, she is on Abbott Elementary, and she is the most recent Celebrity Jeopardy champion. She is really prominent right now.
Was she the lady from The Ferry? Because that's the only other big speaking role from a female.
If it was, I didn't recognize her because it was all happening so fast. And I want to say that woman had blonde hair, and Lisa has red hair.
Well, the only other females that talked were his next door neighbor who's holding her baby every scene you see her.
She's not a bartender.
Right. And the woman on the ferry who has her kid with her or her daughter or whatever. It's the only other women in the movie.
I don't know, but I didn't see her. And she is she's a comedian. She's been around since the 80s, but she's just now getting noticed because of Abbott Elementary. So.
Oh, wait. The other woman is the woman trying to get Rachel when he's having the fight with Robbie. Remember the husband and wife? And she's saying, you need to come with us, honey. Where's your dad?
Yeah, I don't think that's her. That's not her.
All right, well, whomever.
Anyway. And then we have cameos of Ann Robinson and Gene Barry as the grandparents at the end. That was Steven's little nod to the original 50s film.
Huh?
And then I didn't see this guy either, I guess, because I wasn't paying attention. But one of the dock workers was David Harbour
from
Stranger Things. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't recognize him if he was. So, yeah. Great.
So, and then, of course, David Allen Bash played Tim, very familiar face. That's the new father figure in their lives. But I don't know anything. Awards. This thing got 3 Oscar nominations for sound mixing, sound editing, and visual effects, which is to be expected. Mm-hmm. The Academy of Sci-Fi, Fantasy, and Horror gave it 4 nominations for film, actor, director, and screenplay. But it got 1 win for Dakota Fanning, new younger actor, and that makes perfect sense to me.
Yes.
The Razzies nominated Tom Cruise for Worst Actor, and it is one of the few films to be nominated for both Oscars and Razzies. So that's kind of telling.
Okay.
And this movie is not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list, which I can understand that. The original should be, and it may be. I can't remember.
Sound editing, I can give to them because it works really well. This is also the soundtrack in this. The music was composed by John Williams, and it's not good.
I didn't even remember it. All I heard was explosions and screaming.
Well, and there's a lot of sections where there is no music, which makes sense and works. There are other times when he's got music in it, and it doesn't work. He's really good at picking the moments when you need music and the moments when you don't in all of his films. It always has been. I read somewhere that this was the first film that he actually scored without ever seeing it. So he never got to see the movie before he wrote the music for it.
That sucks.
Again, because it was so rushed. They didn't have time to really do it. I do think the sound mixing, though, is great. That tone that they use, I think they use like a didgeridoo or something that's augmented.
The warning, the foghorn, whatever.
It's great and scary and definitely harkens back to the novel because they talk about how chilling it is to hear it.
Yeah.
And everything, which works.
Yeah,
and
I like that.
Especially works in the fairy sequence and all that. A lot of the other times, like the whole underneath the basement when you're trying to be so quiet and the probe is there, that all of this sound in that is great and well done. So I can understand it being nominated for those because that works for this particular movie.
Yeah. I have no trivia and I honestly don't have a lot of keys except for obvious ones. But did you have something else you wanted to say?
The only other trivia I have, one of them you already mentioned, the Ray's reaction when Rachel says, "What is this?" and he notices the dust and he shakes it all off.
Oh, yeah.
That was inspired by 9/11, of course, and all the ash that fell on people and the way they reacted. And
yeah, but in this, it was humans.
Yeah, it was people.
Yeah, in 9/11, I'm sure it was building residue, but this one, man. And you know what? That was actually, of course, the 50s is a key, the 50s version, but the very first murder in the 50s one, you see 3 human bodies shaped like out of ash.
Yep.
So, you know, it was Spielberg making that prominent in this. And I love that. That scene alone creeped the fuck out of me. I mean, just creeped me out because...
In the original?
No, I'm talking about when Tom Cruise gets home and doesn't realize he's got all that shit on him.
Oh, yeah.
And then he just goes in the bathroom and starts trying to get it off of him. And there's just clouds of it coming out of the bathroom. And I'm like, that's people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's human ash.
Yeah.
That
was awful.
I also wonder if that is Schindler-esque or not, the whole, because that was one of the things in Schindler's, is he talks about the cities near Dachau and Auschwitz and everything else that were being covered in human ash.
Yeah.
Because they were burning the Jews.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a key in a really strange way, I guess. And it's also a Spielberg movie.
There's lots of reflections in this movie. And one reviewer I said that had this been a longer production schedule, probably Spielberg may have done something with that, with the amount of reflections in it and the fact that, you know, the reflecting on the aliens and all of that might have been something he could subtext in there, but he didn't have time and didn't do it. I've got, right before we jump to Keys, I've got something I took from Siskel's review, Ebert's review, right? He wrote this about it. He was talking about the alien invasion and the way the aliens, the way the movie treats the aliens and what their mission is or what their goal is. He goes, to what purpose? Why zap what you later want to harvest? Why harvest humans at all, for that matter? Why balance these towering machines on ill-designed supports? If evolution has taught us anything on this planet, it's that limbs of living things, from men to dinosaurs to spiders to centipedes, they tend to come in numbers divisible by two. Three legs are inherently not stable. As the movie demonstrates, when one leg of a giant tripod is damaged and it falls helplessly to the ground, which is true, but it's also kind of creepy and scary the way they do it. So I give it to him, you know?
That's funny.
Yeah. Lots of peril and narrow escapes in this film. If we're collecting humans while we're vaporizing, that's just my watch notes. Yeah. So I guess we can move on.
Yeah. I mean, there's just, it's, you pointed out a lot more things that don't make sense to me than I even realized. The one thing that was the biggest, the two, I was going to say I had four things that I didn't like. I can remember three of them. One's Tom Cruise. One is that the ships are buried under the earth. I was just like, that's so stupid. And then the third one that I can think of is that boy being alive at the end. I was like, are you kidding me? That's just insane. So,
oh yeah.
But
and Robbie lived with huge exclamation points and question marks.
Yeah, stupid. I was like, I also have it's happy. You know, it's a happy ending enough that Dakota Fanning is alive and he got her back to her mother. That's it. That's all you needed.
Yeah.
So
and the
no more happy or it's just sugar.
When H.G. Wells wrote the novel, viruses had just been discovered. And it was a new technology and it was a new thing. So it made sense that it became something that is terrifying us becomes our salvation. It's kind of the irony of the novella. And that kind of works in the 50s Powell version, but it's mostly about the atomic age and the fact that we're going to use nuclear weapon, you know, an atomic bomb on this thing and it still doesn't work. And so it's the Cold War. We're defenseless kind of thing. Our ultimate weapons don't work against the ultimate enemy. So it, again, the irony of a small thing does. Mm-hmm. In this, especially with modern technology and our modern sentiment and science and everything else, viruses don't scare us that much. They can be a pandemic and stop our world.
Right.
But aliens would probably know that. They would probably know something about viruses and probably would wear a spacesuit or something not be contaminated. Something, you know.
It would even be the funny. Ones that, it would have been funny had it been made in this day and age and then they just released COVID on it. Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Have some COVID there. And everybody in the movies wears wears the masks the whole time.
Yeah.
So they don't get it.
There's, you don't have to see Tom Cruise's mug either. You just see his eyes. Let's see how you can act now.
Yeah.
Without that smile.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So it seems, I mean, even the ones in Independence Day had spacesuits on. So there's that. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. I forgot about that.
Number one key, Independence Day. No.
Well, I was just saying, my number one key is the triumvirate of the book, the radio broadcast, and the original movie. I mean, always. Those three are the hugest keys, I think, of any of this.
And there's so many homages like that in it that you have to look at. Like in the movie, in the Powell movie, they're saved in a church at the end because they go into the church and then the machines start crashing. They come out. They figure out what's going on because they all think it's the end. And literally, it's getting louder. They're getting closer. They're going to die, blah, blah, blah. In this one, Spielberg starts the attack at a church because that's the initial structure that falls into the
center that. Right before the preacher. I figured that was kind of an homage, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And there's, yeah, so I think the artilleryman, like I said, which is directly from the H.G. Wells version and all of that. So, it, yeah, all three contribute to this. yeah. and what Spielberg wanted.
And I'm not saying the 50s film is flawless. There's definitely some clunks in
it. Oh, yeah.
I mean, of course. The squared ant scene is one of them. And then them getting separated and him trying to find her in all this chaos is kind of crazy, too. I still love that movie. I think that movie's fantastic.
It is. It's fantastic. I love it. The fact that we have the technology to actually plug into a severed sensor of one of these aliens and see what they
see. And see what you look like in it. Yeah, exactly.
Just so you can scream like the fly or whatever.
But yeah, anyway. That's exactly what it looks like, too.
It does. But yeah, so I agree with you. I think the Trivert is one. I do have Independence Day, not just for the alien design, but also the arrival. The way it is with the whole sky getting dark and then something coming out of it sort of thing. I also have Arrival. Arrival starts the same way. We are intrigued when something comes from the sky and hovers over whatever, whether it's a field or our cities or whatever, and we're suddenly stunned by what are we going to do? How are we going to make contact?
Right. Yeah.
Which is a general trope.
Yeah, I didn't have that, but that makes perfect sense because we covered that so long ago. That was like first season two, I think, or second.
What do you have?
I've only got a couple more. One is that series I mentioned that was another War of the Worlds series in 1988. I never saw it. Did you?
I saw about four episodes of it. Yeah. It wasn't bad. It got a little soap opera-y too soon for me.
Okay.
But it wasn't bad. It might be worth a while. But if it's a series,
they've got to flesh it out because, I mean, this is a really – you mentioned that this is a novella because I've never read it. I thought it was a novel.
Yeah, no, it's a short. If it's a novel, it's a short novel.
It's a very short one. So, I mean, this is like a 1-2 punch, and the 50s movie is a 1-2 punch. Mm-hmm. The Spielberg movie is 2.5 hours long. It's too long.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at is if they made a series out of it, that would have to have a lot of stretch. I mean, a lot of exposition and stuff that's not necessary, I would think. Because
not so much. It becomes much more of a survivalist movie.
Yeah, just do V. You know.
Yeah, essentially. And that would be the big key for that series is V. You know, how do we stop an alien occupation?
Right.
Kind of thing. I've got Jurassic Park just because of the, not only the Kep connection because he wrote it, but the whole Velociraptor in the kitchen sequence, which is a lot like
the basement.
One. In the basement because, you know, it goes around one corner and we're in the background and we sneak over here so it doesn't see us. Mm-hmm. And then it comes back around the other way and we sneak over here so it doesn't see us.
And that to me was some of the worst CGI. Some of that looked really bad to me.
Yeah. Which is my next one, which is, I said, remember we did The Abyss?
Yeah.
One of the first CGI elements, you know, in movies was the tentacle, the water tentacle. It looked a lot better than this thing did.
Yeah.
Anyway. And then my real last one is you may know another trope or another reference to it because you mentioned it, but I think you said Walking Dead. The Ray having to say.
Says, don't listen, and he blindfolds her, and he goes and kills the guy. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, sing your song, blah, blah, blah. And he goes into, although that Spielberg shot, which is a great shot and good framing, but it makes no freaking, you know, when Ogilvy is in the, Harlan's in the foreground digging, because he's going to try to dig to New York or wherever, or Boston, and the doorway's in the back, and you just see Cruz step into it, or Ray step into it, and all of a sudden he goes, and reacts and turns to him. I was going, how did he have a premonition that he's going to kill him? I don't understand. Anyway, but
it's something Walking Dead does a lot better. That's just, it just reminded me because it happens more often on Walking Dead.
Well, I had kind of a really obscure key that came for me, which was MASH. Do you remember the MASH episode where Hawkeye goes crazy?
I'm sure I've seen it, but I don't remember it.
They bring in the psychiatrist that they end up using as a semi-regular in the later seasons, Sidney Friedman, and he's this kind of Jewish mustached psychiatrist. Anyway, Hawkeye's acting really weird and crazy, and we don't know why. Slowly through the episode, he delves into it. Hawkeye was on a bus with a bunch of refugees, South Vietnamese, that were attacked by a North Vietnamese regiment.
I thought that this was the Korea War.
North Korea, South Korea. But anyway, so Korea. Anyway, he keeps having these nightmares of holding this chicken and the chicken is clucking. And they're trying to be quiet so that the North Koreans don't find them. And he ends up having to kill the chicken.
Oh, okay.
In order to save them all. And you keep thinking, okay, we know the gag. What's the deal? Da, da, da. And Sidney keeps trying to probe him, probe him, probe him. Turns out in the very last scene, you see Hawkeye have a full flashback memory. And there's a woman beside him and she has a baby. And he grabs the baby from her. And the baby's crying. And you realize that Hawkeye had to kill the baby in order to save them all. And that's why he has cracked up and lost it. And it's a really emotional, emotional scene.
Well, you're describing the reason I hated MASH.
Well, yeah.
Because that sounds like an Alda episode that he had creative control over.
Oh, yeah.
Because he took that series from being a comedy to being a drama, and it was never meant to be a drama.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. By the last two seasons of MASH, everybody is a writer, everybody is a director, and there are no bad guys.
It sucks. Yeah. It sucks. And I mean, if I watch MASH, it's like I don't go beyond like a season or two, and that's it.
I watched the first few, and then I watched the first season with Winchester. But after that, no, it just doesn't work. But anyway,
I liked it when McLean Stevenson was on it, and he was only on one season.
One season.
Yeah. Really good. And then Frank Burns, the original, you know, and Loretta Swit, of course.
Anyway. But yeah, I just, that whole thing of you have to do something inhumane, uncivilized, wrong, whatever, in order to save either yourself, your family, more people, you know, whatever.
Right.
You got to do the bad thing. Does that make you a bad person? You know, does the lesser of two evils kind of thing.
Right.
So I thought that way. And that could have been so much more had we even cared about Ray. But we, other than, I agree with you, other than Rachel, we don't care about anybody in this movie.
None.
Not I mean, there's not enough backstory for us to care.
No, as a matter of fact, I would have rather Tom Cruise and the son got killed and it'd be Rachel's story and her surviving.
And when you get to a point where we're looking at IMDb and it says a character's name and we don't even know who that character was in the movie, there's some character issues with your screenplay. So
I have one last key and you're not going to be surprised at all. It's Night of the Living Dead.
Oh, yeah.
In the very beginning, all the foreshadowing. You start hearing stuff like on TVs and radios in the background, and you're like, something's happening. And it's the same way when Johnny is in that car and turns that radio off at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. We mentioned it last week.
Yep.
And if it's, no, Johnny, don't turn the radio off. If you listen, you'll know what's going on.
And that's a thing of we are ahead of them.
Right.
We know what's going to happen. Yeah, mm-hmm. We as audience members are ahead of the characters.
Yeah, it's a great – I guess it could be a trope. It's definitely a device that filmmakers and novelists use, for sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
When we know more than they know.
Right, because it makes the reader or the viewer feel like they're part of it because they understand what's happening.
Yeah, and that's why I was thinking, you know, if I had more time to rewrite, more time to look at the script, more time to play with it, you know, what other layers could they have? Because there's so much about this story that we as audience members know already. Mm-hmm. Either we saw the George Powell movie or we listened to the broadcast or we read the novel. So we know what's going to happen. So what can you do different other than a ferry boat and some blood weeds?
They don't do the hand on her shoulder like they do in the 50s one.
Which would have been great for Rachel.
But the 50s one reminds me of E.T., you know, as soon as he panics and runs out and he goes,
Well, but that's the key. That's why Spielberg did that, though, was because of that.
Because of E.T.?
No, in E.T., he did that because of War of the Worlds. That's what he was homaging.
I could see that.
The other one in this one that is a definite Spielberg homage is when Ray, you know, Rachel's gone. He's trying to find her. She's been abducted. He goes running out, but he goes to the front door and it cuts to that back shot of him opening up the door and everything is red and covered in the blood.
Encounters.
Well, it's closing, but more than that, it's Wizard of Oz. because he's coming from this really gray, dark basement color, almost saturated color look, and suddenly there's red and a red lake and red things, tendrils everywhere and all this.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was like, the whole time I kept thinking, you're establishing that these aliens are not from Mars like they are in the book, yet you have right. a scene where the entire planet looks red. That just looks yeah. weird. I mean, it seems like a misplaced homage almost.
Almost. I mean, again, this is a movie that I would probably try one time watching without any audio. Because visually, I think it's very well done mm-hmm. and cool. But
and you don't have to hear her scream.
But yeah, right. But plot-wise, it makes no sense. And overall character development doesn't matter. You don't have to listen to it to watch the pretty pictures that Spielberg puts together. So there's that. And I love the man, but that's my
he's not on perfect, it. And neither is John Carpenter, and neither is George Romero, but we true. Still love them.
And that's what Tim and I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think David and I would recommend this movie, maybe. I mean, it would be for strange reasons if we did, probably for special effects or something, but I wouldn't recommend it. It's not on 1001. No. We just listed what we call keys. We don't really talk about it as much as we do in our introduction, but things that, you know, that this movie was influenced from are influenced in the future from mm-hmm. this film. Anyway, that's our take on it this week. David, I'm a little shocked because we only have two episodes left.
Two.
Three, including this one, and we usually like to go out on a high, and this was not really a high. I think I put it in the rotation because Spielberg directed it, but oh well. Such is life. Yeah,
such is life. You know, when Spielberg gets a 90%, it's going to be good.
So. Yeah, and if I'm not mistaken, I love the next movie, but I'm not crazy about its ending, too. And it's our last horror movie of the season.
Oh, so, next week is horror? Okay.
Yeah, and then we'll go out with the sci-fi. And we'd like to thank all you folks for joining us. Yes. As you know, if you're watching us on YouTube, please subscribe, like, and or comment down there. Anything you do like that helps us. We also have some other shows that you may enjoy on YouTube, including coming attraction shows and little horror ditties that I do, as well as top fives. And if you really want to support us, as I mentioned earlier, we have some shows over on Patreon. Mm-hmm. Some of them are bonus episodes that you can just watch for free. Some of them are bonus episodes that are a part of a $2 tier, and some of them are secondary shows, one on the X-Files and one on Star Trek, and that's a little slightly higher tier. So for the cost of a cup of coffee, two if you're feeling generous, you get all this. And I counted the other day, there's over 100 episodes over there, so there's plenty to choose from.
Please, it helps us tremendously offset all the cost of like web design and equipment and maintaining our website.
Software is becoming so important to us now. That's all I'm going to say. We'll be back with you next week, and until next time, I'll see you, David.
Bye.
Bye. What was it? Did I forget something?
No, but that was just an abrupt. See you, David. Okay. Bye. Okay.
Really? Well, no, I forgot. I had already said we'll be in Horrorland. I just didn't have it for a tag. So it felt like I didn't close the way I would normally close.
Anyway. Okay. Okay. So what are we? We're doing 30 days, right? That's next?
Yeah.
No, wait. Star Trek is Thursday, and then 30 days is Tuesday.